This is Regionally Speaking, Reporters Roundtable Thursday here on Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Chris Nolte. And let's first turn to Carol Carlson, who's a reporter for the Post Tribune, about a couple stories that she's offered up out there online and in print. One about the latest controversy involving the city of Gary, and in particular about one of the common council members, and the other about the perennial problems with the Gary Community School Corporations. And as always, Carol, thank you for being with us on the program today.
Having me.
Well, let's start in first here about the latest involving Ron Brewer, the president of the Gary Common Council. We know, of course, at least from the information from the police departments about what got him in trouble to begin with and all. But he's had, I guess, a chance to say his two cents worth. And tell us about that.
Yeah. To recap the incident, it happened, began on September 21st when Brewer was at a gas station in Gary and went in, I assumed, to pay and left his keys in the car, and some folks stole the car. And he said, in a statement on Tuesday, at Tuesday's council meeting, that he called the Gary police immediately. And then the next day, he was able to use, he had checked his bank card, which was also in the car, mm-hmm. and he was able to use a GPS tracker and located the car in the Hammond, Chicago area. And he indicated that he went to see where the car was, physically went in another car with his wife. And that's what led to the incident. He encountered the suspects who were in his car. They were teenagers, according to East Chicago police, and police said Brewer actually blocked their car in. Well, it was actually his car. Blocked the car, and the people in the car ran. He was able to catch one of them, a 14-year-old boy. And this, he was talking to a dispatcher during some of this incident, and he was telling the dispatcher that he was going to take this teenager back to Gary. That's what he did. And that kind of has set off this whole flurry of accusations and charges. Formal charges against Brewer have not been filed as of yet. Don't know if that's coming or not.
Mm-hmm.
The Chicago police had some harsh words for Brewer's actions, saying that he was right to call the police, but not right to place the kid in his own vehicle and go off with him, suggesting that could be kidnapping.
Well, that's what I was wondering. You know, that's opening up a whole other can of worms, so to speak.
Right. So Brewer was in attendance at Tuesday's council meeting, and he does chair the meeting as president of the council.
Mm-hmm.
And at the onset of the meeting, he did make a statement that kind of gave his side of the story, saying that he did not intend to hurt anybody, just wanted to get his property back, and was trying to work with police while he did that. So that brought out some condemnation from a few citizens who attended the meeting.
Yeah.
One suggested that he resign, and Brewer had no comment about actually resigning at the end.
Well, I know that the call for resignation came from a longtime critic, a longtime landlord, a longtime critic of things in the city of Gary, Jim Nowacki. So
right.
It's not surprising, I guess, to hear him say that he should call for Mr. Brewer to resign from the council seat.
Not real surprising to hear it come from Nowacki.
Yeah.
Other council members did not address the issue. Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson said after the meeting that there shouldn't be a rush to judgment on Brewer, and let's just see how it unfolds.
Mm-hmm. Well, that might be the reason why the East Chicago police are being very careful about this whole matter. And I guess if they in turn have conferred with the Lake County Prosecutor's Office about it too, they probably want to be sure they do the right thing and don't overstep themselves.
There was also a report during the incident that there were shots fired, but we haven't that yet, but that's what we are also hearing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how that's going to play into it.
Is that a case where that specialized shot detecting software that the that East Chicago police have might have shown up, and maybe it showed up because of that?
Right.
So it may not actually have been something that resulted from the incident involving Ron Brewer. So that's interesting. So, well, it's another one of those stay tuned episodes, I guess, in this story to be sure. The second one that you've just put out in the Post Tribune online and in print today is an update on yesterday's visit by the Indiana State Board of Education to Gary. They, I guess, were meeting there at Ivy Tech. No, excuse me. It was Indiana University Northwest Ivy Tech is what it is, the combination.
Right.
But they also had a big tour of a lot of other buildings, and a lot of very unhappy people showed up for the meeting. Tell us about that, please.
Yeah, I was a little bit surprised at that the number of people and the tenor of their comments. It didn't look like it was an organized effort to come out. Various people just showed up, and the state board always holds a public comment period at the onset of its meeting, and the public comments given yesterday all pertain to conditions in the schools, whether it be Roosevelt operated by Edison Learning or the Gary Community Schools operated by MGT Consulting, both private companies.
Right.
At various times, Edison Learning had a state contract. Now it has a contract with the school district.
We bring us up to date on what the situation is. I mean, you're probably going to be going into that, but to let our listeners know if they're maybe forgetful about some of the problems that not only that Roosevelt has being under a private operator a lot longer, I guess, than you think about it, that the rest of the Gary Community School Corporations has.
Yeah, it's a little confusing with Roosevelt, and I have to catch myself to think about the history. But back in 2011, when Tony Bennett was actually state superintendent of public instruction, Roosevelt became one of the first schools in the state to be taken over by the Department of Education after failing ISTEP for, I think, six or seven straight years.
Mm-hmm.
And they did that by virtue of the state law that had been on the books for a while but had never been enforced. So this time the hammer came down and the state came in and they hired Edison Learning, and the company came in and did its thing at the school, but academic grades really never got better. They continued to get F's. But the time period with that state takeover elapsed, and by this time there was a good relationship between the school district and Edison Learning. And they decided jointly to embark on this innovative schools program in an effort to pull up the grade there, and they entered into a five-year contract that expires in 2022. So Edison Learning is still there, but the school has reverted back to the auspices of the school district. And adding to the problems, last February, when we had that cold weather, the pipes burst at Roosevelt. The school became flooded with water. Students, of course, could not be in the classroom. So the kids were moved to the Gary Area Career Center. And the repair cost at the Roosevelt building is so high that school officials are still pondering what to do about that. In the meantime, the kids are at the Career Center. So that's where we left off, and that's where it started on during yesterday's meeting.
Mm-hmm.
The board member from Northwest Indiana, Tony Walker, had toured the Career Center to visit the Edison Learning Roosevelt kids, and he found some of them were being housed in garage bays because the school is kind of at capacity right now because the Career Center enrollment has increased. So there's a lot of kids in there. Edison Learning has almost 500 kids.
Yeah.
So that was their only recourse, was to bring partitions in and make a couple classrooms in these garage bays. And the day Walker and some state officials were there, it was pretty hot. It was that Tuesday. It was almost 90.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, warm and humid. And that's not going to bode well for this winter either, I imagine.
No, so Walker was mad, and he opened up the meeting talking about his tour of Westside High School, where he said the library had several leaks from the roof. And then there were problems with garages at the Career Center, and the meeting took off from there with every person sharing their grievances about the school district.
Well, it sounds like certainly Tony had more than his share to say to his fellow board members at the meeting, and of course what he has to say probably realistically carries more weight than unfortunately some of the people who have youngsters going to the schools, and we know that some of the parents were certainly there to make sure their voices were heard. They weren't happy about the situation, at least.
Yeah, there was a lot of passion on display, that's for sure, by mm-hmm. the parents. And then Walker took the state board members over to the Career Center, and they saw firsthand the students in the garage bays, talked to some of them, I believe. So the board did agree to take up the matter. I don't know what exactly they could do. The state still has partial control over Roosevelt, so they vowed to address the matter at their meeting in November, so we'll see what they come up with.
Well, do you think that, and Justin, your opportunities, because you get to see it up close so often, that that maybe what the state might be able to do is have to find some emergency funds someplace and get some portable classrooms in, at least to take care of the situation for the students that are having to spend their classroom times in the bay of the garage?
That would be one option, and that was not brought up, but that would certainly be one resolution to the problem, at mm-hmm. least to get them through the rest of the school year and be in a climate-controlled setting where kids won't be hot or cold.
Now, we know that that it's not unusual for schools to have to set up portable classrooms, and even the most recent issues we know is in the Lake Ridge School Corporation in Calumet Township, another area close to Gary, where they've had to close up a school and shift students around to make them fit in within the schools that they have open, and they've had to bring some temporary classrooms in one of their locations to help accommodate the shift of students around. So it's not unusual. So it just sounds like that they've got something more important to talk about here. I know they had some other issues that came up as far as the state education system is concerned, but they seem to be eclipsed by the, as you say, about the drama that happened in Gary yesterday.
Yeah, there were a few other complaints, but nothing, everything seemed to be about the conditions in the school, mm-hmm. problems with the roofs, overcrowding. The state board pretty much got an earful.
That sounds to be sure. And so it'll be another great set of stories coming out of that, to be sure, soon. Carol Carlson's reporter for the Post Tribune. And as always, Carol, thank you for spending time going over the stories that you have out there in print and online. And we're looking forward to having a chance to have you back on again soon.
Thank you very much, Chris.
You're welcome. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Continuing on with Reporters Roundtable Thursday on Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio, we talk with Hannah Reed with the Post Tribune, and she's come out with a very interesting, if not surprising, story, maybe to some, about how birth rates in Northwest Indiana seem to have changed over the last decade. Hannah, first off, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, tell us first how you got your information together, and give us more about what you've discovered about birth rates and how they seem to be on the decline here in the region.
Okay, so I read a story on the Denver Post about how birth rates and fertility rate in Colorado had declined. And so I was curious about how it had declined in Indiana, both the state as a whole and Northwest directly, just to see how it affected where we are. And I went on statsindiana.org, and I found that in Indiana as a whole, the births from 2007 to 2017 were down by 7,000. So I decided to go a little bit deeper and see, you know, Lake and Porter counties, how are they doing? And so I figured out from 2007 to 2017, it was down over 1,000 births. And I just thought it was something that was super interesting, and so I wanted to talk to people in the area to see what they thought about it, or people who were childless by choice or were going to be childless by choice, what they were thinking about the whole thing.
Tell us about some of the people that you did talk to. I know one of them in particular is an important academician at IU Northwest in Gary. In fact, the lady who's the director of Women's and Gender Studies on the Gary campus. Tell us what she had to say and why she felt that having children was not her choice.
Right. So I talked to Dr. Foltz, the director of Women's and Gender Studies at Indiana University Northwest, and she is also childless by choice. And that was something that I didn't know even going into the interview. I originally just wanted to talk to her because she was the director of women's and gender studies, and I thought maybe she would have some insight into the topic.
Right.
But she ended up telling me, you know, she was childless by choice. She's been happily divorced since the 1990s, and her reasoning behind it was just because she said at the time when she was married, her and her husband wanted to be able to travel and wanted to be able to do other things without having, you know, children to put into daycare or take care of or do that type of thing. And she did say it wasn't because she said she loves children. You know, it wasn't because she doesn't like children. It was just not something in her that she felt she needed to fulfill.
And I understand, too, you talk to some young couples, too. So it's not just some thought of some people who are mature adults. It's younger adults as well, too, I understand.
Yeah, I talked to a girl, Nikki Jones, from Dyer. And she is, I believe, 23, she said. And her and her fiance Jake, he has kids from different relationships. Mm-hmm. So she's going to be like a stepmother to these children, but she said she's helped raise them, and that has in part, you know, I guess satisfied the maternal instincts that she had. And so for that reason, you know, she's saying from now on, like, kids aren't really in the picture, although she didn't think that they were in the first place, because she said in the past she never really wanted kids. She wanted to be able to travel and, like, have independence and, you know, do all that type of stuff, which you can do when you have kids, but it's a little bit more difficult. So she said that her fiance having kids, you know, has solidified her want to not have them herself. And she said at the most she'd probably be a foster parent just because she believes that the world is overpopulated already and these kids in foster care don't get the attention that they deserve, and she wants to be able to help the community but not add to the community, like, physically.
I wonder, too, if it isn't also a concern that women may have, and maybe you found out in putting together your story for the Post-Tribune online and in print, that it turns out that there's maybe a bias out there against women that have children that are out there in the job market right now?
Right, so Dr. Foltz did say that, you know, sometimes women who have a family are seen as not as serious. They're seen as people who are going to need special hours so they can be with their kids at certain times, or seen as people who are going to need to leave work to go, like, pick up a kid when they're sick or something of that sort.
Right.
And they're seen as not wanting to put in extra hours because they have children at home, versus, you know, men who have children, that never really seems to be something that they have to deal with in the workplace. And it also is this expectation with women that Dr. Foltz said the expectation is that whether or not they have children now, they're able to have children in the future. And that means that, you know, the company is going to need to process maternity leave and find someone to take their spot. So even if women are not planning on having children, they're seen as someone who could need this time off if they do.
Is there a concern that maybe the researchers have noted, or maybe we'll find out in the future, about the fact that the birth rate drops in Indiana, and that it's going to have an impact not only on families, the size of families, but it'll have an impact on the job market as well?
I didn't see any concern about that. One of the things I did see was the fact that women are waiting later in life to have their children, mm-hmm. So the fertility rate has gone down along with the birth rate. And what that means is the fertility rate is the rate in which women are usually expected to have children. So between like 15 and 44 is the fertility rate. And the birth rate is, you know, the number of births that are happening. And so what I saw in my research was that women were waiting until their late 30s or early 40s to have their children versus, you know, having them at like 26 or 27. Or just choosing not to have children at all, which decreases both the fertility and the birth rate.
So do you see that there may be, although it maybe seem flippant to say so, that there are pros and cons in waiting before having children?
Yeah, I talked to Dr. Foltz about pros and cons. And one of the pros that she noted was, you know, you can have economic stability, mm-hmm. and not have to worry about, you know, spending money on a child or saving for a child education or, you know, putting money into them, as well as being able to focus on your job and, like, go forward in your profession and achieve goals that are not impossible to do if you have children, but do seem a little bit more difficult. And so, like, there are cons. There are also cons in waiting, though, because, you know, Dr. Fultz said most of the cons have to do with health complications. And the fact that it's more difficult to physically have a child without complications as women age, just because, you know, when you're waiting, your body at 26 is a lot different than your body at 42. So it's not like it's impossible, but there are different health complications.
That sounds like a lot of interesting and maybe to some people alarming facts that have come out as a result of the study that you did and your research that you've done, as well as the story that's out there in the Post Tribune online and in print. What did your editors think about the idea you probably had to pitch to them about this and the story that's come out?
Yes, so as an intern, I kind of try to pitch stories that I think are, you know, I take them from national news and I kind of pull them to Northwest Indiana. Mm-hmm. So I think I was really excited to pitch this idea just because I thought it was a really exciting topic to look into, and my editor seemed excited to have it. So, yeah, it got a lot of positive feedback.
That's good to hear. Well, Hannah, thank you for sharing your information with us and the story that you put out there in the Post Tribune in print and online concerning the decline of birth rates in Northwest Indiana, and the research that in the comments you got locally as well, too, from folks that had some very definite viewpoints about it. And we hope to have you back on again soon.
Thank you for having me.
This is Regionally Speaking, Reporters Roundtable Thursday here on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Let's find out more about a very interesting story. We've heard stories from NPR about the cost of health care, and particularly lately from the Indiana Public Broadcasting Station's crew about concern about health care costs. In fact, recently a group has gotten together to protest outside the Indianapolis office of Senator Young to talk about the push to get health care costs and drug expenses down in particular. And Giles Bruce from The Times has put out an article called Cost of Living, How to Afford Insulin, and of course dealing with diabetes care here in Northwest Indiana. And Giles, thank you for being with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Chris.
Well, tell us first about the research that you got to do in getting things together for this article.
Yeah, well, this article is part of a series that we started. It's actually the first article in a series called Cost of Living, where we're looking at various medications and treatments, medical treatments that people often have trouble affording, and then looking at what resources are available in Northwest Indiana, what kind of discount programs and the like that people can access. So we started with insulin and diabetes care in general because insulin is one of the more expensive drugs out there, and one that has gone up astronomically in price over the last few years. I included some research on the cost and the price and what's some of the reasons for that increase are, and talked to some diabetes patients who mm-hmm. have run into obstacles trying to get their medication and treatment, and then talk to some local hospitals, health centers who try to assist lower income people with affording these things.
One person in particular that you talked to that's highlighted in the story is Jeremy Kursak. He's from DeMott, and he has been basically born with type 1 diabetes. That's the type that stays with you for as long as you live. It's not like type 2, which you develop sometimes as you get older, but you mentioned about his particular problems in trying to get hold of insulin. It's not very good, especially because he's out of work and he's trying to deal with other costs in addition to staying alive with his diabetes medication.
Yeah, he lost his job last October and his insurance along with it, and had been able to afford his insulin until that point, but without insurance it was about $300 a month for his insulin. So mm-hmm. Luckily he was able to get some money from his mom to help pay for that, has since been declared as being disabled, so now he gets his insurance through Medicaid, which is the government program for poor and disabled people, and so he's able to afford it now, but it was tough for him for a while, and he mm-hmm. was just surprised how much it had gone up in over the years.
And I know you had a chance to talk with some of the healthcare providers here in the region for your story with HealthLink, which is the community health center network, seems to be set up here in the region. What do they say about how they're able to help their patients deal with the cost of insulin and other expenses that they have because of their diabetes?
Yeah, there are a lot of different programs out there, thankfully. You know, one that community health centers like HealthLink use is called the 340B program. It's a federal program that gives discounted medications to clinics and hospitals that serve low-income people. So they're able to help most of their patients get cheaper medications through that. Otherwise, there are programs directly through the drug companies in many cases, where they'll give you free medications or discount medications. Beyond that, there's apps, websites, discount cards through programs like GoodRx, Rx Assist, FamilyWise. There's a whole list of them in my article. A lot of these places also try to work on prevention and helping with symptoms, helping with people on diabetes how to work out their diets and exercise routines and things like that. To try to keep them healthy, and those programs are generally free.
And I know you mentioned in particular one fellow from Valparaiso who has, unfortunately, his situation with his diabetes is a matter, I guess, that he has to try and work out himself as far as his own cost because of, kind of falling through the cracks, as it were. Joshua Sharon has a very interesting situation. Tell us what he was running into in trying to get his insurance company to cover his diabetes medication.
Yeah, well, Joshua, he was on, he preferred a specific type of diabetes medication that was a brand name, a little more costly, and his insurer declined to pay for it. It wasn't on their list of medications they would cover. they wouldn't, also wouldn't pay for some of his supplies, so his out-of-pocket costs had been about $400 a month. But then his pharmacy told him about one of these discount programs through the pharmaceutical companies. So he is now, for the time being, I guess for the next 4 months at least, that's when, where he may have to renew or try again. But, he's now getting that medication free, at least for a few months.
Now, you mentioned that this is a series of articles that is coming out in print as well as in online in the Times. What are some of the other topics that you're going to be able to take up in the next parts of the series?
Yeah, well, we would, we'd like to look into some other, areas that, people have trouble accessing or particularly costly medications, EpiPens could be one. And there's, mental health treatments, treatment for opioid addiction, things like that. So we'll have, with the healthcare system the way it is, with it being so costly, they're going to be plenty of things to write about.
Oh, well, certainly so. Well, looking forward to those stories when they come out here. Thanks very much, Giles, for this particular article dealing with the extreme cost for many people of getting covered for their diabetes and the other medications coming up too. Thanks for spending some time with us today to talk about this topic.
Okay. Talk to you later, Chris.
We'll talk to you later. Giles Bruce is a reporter for The Times, and he covers healthcare and other related issues. A Hammond woman is making a name for herself in the science, technology, engineering, and math, or STEM field, and has been named the up-and-coming woman of the year in STEM. Michelle Murday is Northwest Indiana branch manager for EnviroForensics. She was chosen by the Northwest Indiana Influential Women's Association. She talks with Lakeshore Public Radio Sharon Jackson about her career and her plans to help young women get into STEM fields.
So I'm originally from Northwest Indiana, graduated from Munster, and then from Munster went to Ball State, and then lived in Indianapolis 5 years before I moved back up here last year.
Okay, well, congratulations. I understand that there's an inaugural award in STEM, and you have been named up-and-coming Woman of the Year in Science, Technology, Engineering, and Math.
Yes.
Congratulations. How did you do that?
Thank you. So it all started was I was nominated. I'm not 100% sure by who. And then from there, you go through an application process. It's pretty lengthy, pretty extensive, letters of recommendation, any awards, publications, your resume. You know, they ask you some questions about how you chose your field, challenges and obstacles you might have had along the way.
So how did you choose your field and how did you get into STEM?
Okay, so it's a pretty funny story. When I was in high school, probably just like everyone else, trying to figure out what I wanted to do, I actually applied to Ball State with entrepreneurship because I thought I wanted to own my own restaurant after working at the Shoops in Munster throughout high school. And then when it got to, I think it was my senior year, second semester, I took an earth space science class. And when we got to the rock and mineral sections, it just completely piqued my interest. It's nothing I had ever thought about. So from there, I started thinking, you know, is this something I could do? What's there to even do with rocks? You know, most people are like, how is rocks a career? So then from there, I actually purchased a book called Great Jobs for Geology Majors. And after reading the first couple of chapters in that, I had switched my career path at Ball State from entrepreneurship to geology.
Is your job, does it have to do with geology now?
It did when I first started. So when I first started at Enviroforensics, I was a field geologist, and that required me to go out and collect a lot of soil, water, and vapor samples. And in collecting those samples, you also have to describe any lithology you see, so the different types of soils that you can collect.
How did you kind of move up through the ranks in your job? But tell me a little bit about your career then.
Okay, so when I was a field geologist, we obviously did, I was more out in the field performing the oversight of all the investigation activities. And, you know, a lot of that's to determine the historical spills on the site. So we collect those samples and they go to a lab. And then from the lab, we can tell where the spill might have, general area of where the spill might have been released and to what extent and if we need to investigate any further or not. And then while I was also a field geologist, I performed the oversight of the remedial activities. So once we got full site investigation, then we could go through and figure out how are we going to clean up the issue. And then from there, I started writing some of the, like, our smaller reports, began analyzing the data. And about a year and a half into my career, I was promoted to a staff geologist. And that's where I started to write some of the larger investigation and remediation reports and then interpreting the analytical data. And then to help with that, it would be to develop our conceptual site models. And then as part of that, Enviroforensics gave me the opportunity to go to Golden, Colorado to learn a software called RockWorks. And that actually allows us to prepare three-dimensional visualizations of the contamination. So we can actually put everything into this software and it'll give us, you know, the plume shape, size, you can put in lithology, the groundwater elevation. So it's kind of really cool to see, maybe a little hard to describe over the phone of what exactly it looks like. And then from there, I was promoted to project manager. And then at that time, kind of more of what it sounds, I began managing each of the projects by implementing and advancing the investigation and remediation activities, just to make sure, you know, everything's done within the work scopes, preparing the work scopes, making sure everything's to quality control standards. And then we also have to manage all the administrative, budgetary, and technical aspects of all of our assigned projects.
For women, you know, who are in high school now and they want to get into STEM, what's your advice to them?
So STEM, trades, arts, or any other career, just follow your gut and do something that you're passionate about. If anyone says you can't do it or shouldn't do what you want to do, just use that to fuel your fire. Every time somebody told me I couldn't do it or I wasn't going to make it in my career path, I wanted to prove them wrong that much more and show them that I could do it and I was meant to do something that I wanted to do. And then some days will be hard and challenging, but those days you know that you are learning. And if you aren't sure of an answer or how to do something, never be afraid to ask questions and treat every day as a learning experience and never stop growing.
Did people actually tell you along the way that you wouldn't make it?
Multiple. Probably the end of my junior year, I was the president for the Ball State Geological Society. And one of the people at the job fair, another lady actually came up to me and told me that I was never going to make it because I was there in high heels. And everyone in the environmental field is always in some kind of steel-toed boots. And to this day, I find it funny because I wear high heels daily, but I do have my steel-toed boots in my car at all times.
Very good.
Right?
Very good. Congratulations to you on all that.
Thank you.
What are your future plans, and how are you going to, I mean, being in the position that you are, how are you going to give back to the community?
I would really like to start mentoring maybe a couple of women in the area, or even a group of women that maybe are interested in a career path in STEM, just, you know, to help them maybe get through some of the struggles that they might have along the way, or insecurities, or just, you know, questions. Because some of my classes, I know I was the only female in an all-male class, and sometimes that in itself could be intimidating. So just give them the encouragement that you can get through it.
You know, I don't want to be negative, but why is it so hard for women to get into STEM? I mean, is it, and it seems like more guys get into it. Is it just like the way our brains are wired?
That's a question that I wish I knew the answer to. I don't know if it's just a more of a gender role type thing of, you know, you grow up and all your friends are going into X, Y, or Z, and why do you have to fall in one of those categories? Why can't you go into a STEM field?
That's Michelle Murday, who is the Northwest Indiana Branch Manager for Enviro Forensics, and she has just been named the up-and-coming Woman of the Year in STEM by an organization here in Northwest Indiana called the Northwest Indiana Influential Women's Association. Bernard Carter has been the Lake County Prosecuting Attorney for, if the math is correct, 26 years now, and he wants to run again. In fact, he's decided, even though the election that he would campaign in and run again doesn't come up for a while, he's decided to take an early decision to get out there and make himself known to everyone that he wants another term of office. And we are lucky to have him in the studio with us to talk about it. Mr. Carter, thank you very much for being with us.
It was a pleasure to be here.
Well, let's ask the question, why did you decide in 2019 that you are going to run for office in 2022?
That's correct. Ordinarily, in a mid-year term, you either make some indication that you're going to run. So usually it's done about a year before the election actually takes place. Mm-hmm. In this particular occasion, one of the reasons I did it, as mentioned, I've been prosecutor for 26 years. I enjoy what I do. I'm very passionate in what I do. I'm an avid community speaker, avid activist in working in the community, trying to reduce crime. I find that that's my passion, as well as in the courtroom, as well as managing 200 people in my office. And one of the things that was brought to my attention, that there were people going around saying, you know, Bernie's not going to run again, and let's do some other plans. And I just wanted to make it perfectly clear that I have all intentions of running again. I certainly are doing everything I can to make Lake County a better place. I'm committed to that. And I didn't want that rumor in the back saying, oh, he's going to give it up. In light of the fact that I've been here 26 years, that would be something that people would digest. They say, well, you know, he's been there a long time, so maybe he is giving it up. And I wanted to indicate to them that I don't have that desire. The people in my office, I have some fantastic workers, bees in my office, as I call them. That's the support staff, that's the secretaries, that's the attorneys, the investigators in our office, caseworkers in our office. They are all professional people who aren't political. The only political person really in reality, and this has been kind of historical in terms of my term, the only political person per se in my office is me. Mm-hmm. I don't try to bring in political people to try to help me be political. I don't bring in political people to try to help me handle the politics of staying in office. What I do is hire people who are good people who have nothing to do with politics, who are come with a tool, come with desire, come with the education to be the best attorney, the best worker they possibly can be, and that's all I ask of them. And then in return, the citizens of Lake County get a good product, and they don't get a product that is being tarnished by overemphasis of politics inside the office. And I don't talk politics inside the office. I don't allow my employees to talk politics with me inside the office, and I like it that way. And in light of that, those rumors are saying, well, Bernie Carter's not running again. I had to quiet those rumors to say, I'm definitely running again. And I think I serve the people well, and I will continue to do so.
What was the situation like 26 years ago? Now, you'd served as a judge before then.
That's correct.
And you'd serve, of course, as an attorney before judges.
That's correct.
And probably before prosecutors, too, on cases that you had. But what was the situation like 26 years ago? And I suppose the obvious answer would be a lot worse than it is today.
Yes.
But what was the situation as far as law enforcement and the state of crime, so to speak, in Lake County like when you came into office the first time?
Well, when I first came into office, as mentioned, I used to be a deputy prosecutor, and then I went on to be on the bench for 4 years, and then Evan Bayh appointed me prosecutor. I didn't run for prosecutor. Mm-hmm. I got appointed by the then governor, Evan Bayh, which at the time, state statutes allowed the governor to make an appointment in case of a vacancy. John DiGiulio had left and went to the Jack Crawford had left and went to the Gaming Commission. John DiGiulio came in and took his position, and then as John was there, he got an offer to be United States Attorney for the Northern District. So he said, you know, that was a desire that he wanted, and he's now a federal judge in the Northern District, located in South Bend. So John wanted to be a U.S. attorney, wanted to be a federal judge, so he went in that direction. So when that position opened up, I got a call from Evan Bayh. I didn't solicit it. I got a call from Evan Bayh saying, Bernie, would you be interested in it? I think you should put your name in. Mm-hmm. So when the governor tells you to put your name in and he's the one making a selection, that's a kind of clear indication that I might have a good shot at it. I put my name in. But absent that call, I would have never put my name in. How the situation is today, one of the reasons I left the bench is because I thought I had a gift to give to the community. Not only my legal aspect of it, not only that I had done 3 death penalty cases by that time, I had done 56 murder cases, I've done a host of rapes, robberies, every type of case you can imagine. Before I became prosecutor, I had prosecuted all those cases, and I did real well. My statistics were good, my conviction rate was good, and I had a passion for the courtroom. But the main passion I had was trying to reach out to our youth, try to get our youth to understand that you don't have to go down that road. And you don't have to be in a violent situation. You may have grown up in a situation that festered that type of activity, but you don't have. You can say no to it. So I've been spending my whole career, the last 26 years, doing just that. And I think, you know, it's hard to measure it, but I certainly know it made a difference. I have so many young people come to me and say, you know, Mr. Carter, you spoke to me 10 years ago, 15 years ago, and now I'm a lawyer, a doctor. I'm working in the mill. I'm living good. And I was in the wrong direction at the time when you had that discussion with me, and what you said kind of resonated and is one of the contributing factors to where I'm at today. I've had so many. My wife told me the other day, she met this photographer, and he said that, you know, I talked to your husband 20 years ago, and he just kind of electrified me and motivated me to say, I'm not going to be like my dad. His father was in prison. His grandfather was in prison. He said, I'm not going to be a third generation in prison, and that kind of motivated him. So that gives me a good indication that I think I'm on the right track. How you measure that, it's hard to measure it because we do have crime today. Our crime is down. Right now we have, unfortunately, 41 homicides in this county. When I took office, we were in excess of 100 for a year. So that has reduced drastically, and I'm not saying it was because of me, it's because of law enforcement. I think it's because of some of the things that is done by a lot of the activists and public service people have a lot to do with it. One of the things that I think is very clear is that society, this is not just Lake County, but society put too much emphasis on law enforcement. When I say law enforcement, I mean the police, the prosecutor, and the courts, and the prisons. They put too much emphasis on those four entities solving our problems. It ain't going to happen. It don't happen. Law enforcement is a reactionary event. Police come when there's a demand. Prosecutors prosecute when the case is there. Judges sentence based on what's there. Prisons house you because you've been sent there. All reactionary branches. So we have to have, as a society, as a government, and I think as a community, we have to have people being in a positive direction and trying to deter crime so it don't get to us. And there's methods and there's people out there doing that, and I think it's effective. So to answer your question, certainly the homicide rate, the violent crime rate has been reduced, but it's still too high.
We still have problems, unfortunately, with drugs. They've been with us forever, it seems. Are we dealing better with the opioid crisis and with the meth crisis now than we have in the years past?
No, absolutely not. And I give you a couple of examples. I say very strongly, and people, you know, take issue with this sometimes, but I don't see it, the facts are there. The pharmaceutical companies and many of our doctors are bigger drug dealers than the drug dealers that are on the streets in our county. And I say that very, very seriously and very profound. And I, as mentioned, you and I were talking off record here, I was on the governor's task force.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the consensus that the task force came up with. And all professional people, medical people on that, professors, law enforcement, the state superintendent of police, all of us were on that committee. A real nice group of people and a balance of people. And one of our findings was that the pharmaceutical companies put pressure on doctors to prescribe many of these drugs that patients later, and we have thousands of cases and examples of that, where people later were addicted to, and once they was prescribed 2 or 3 weeks, and they became addicted to it, and then they jump around finding doctor after doctor to give them medication, and then when the doctors finally say, enough is enough, you don't have the problem, you got an addiction problem, you don't have a medical problem, you don't have pain. Then they go to the streets and buy the drugs. So the pharmaceutical companies as well as the doctors, and they've been sued, and a lot of them have been sued. The pharmaceutical companies are as responsible as many of the drug cartel. And that's the sad part. So that's a new ingredient to our addiction problem. We've always had an addiction problem in this country. I don't know how far you go back in the 30s and the 40s and
oh,
the 50s.
Oh, yeah, that's right. We know this.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you've seen it more now if you look back in terms of the entertainment field. Many of our great artists and great jazz players and were addicted to drugs, and they had that underground heroin market. Well, they were addicted to it, but certainly the lay persons were also out there doing the same thing too.
One of the other issues I know that you're very, very strong on and have done your best to push for is to try to resolve and at least try to maybe better to say prioritize the sex crimes that have happened, domestic violence cases that have happened here in Lake County. And you've asked for some help, and the county council is doing their best to help you, trying to seek some federal funds. Tell us what the latest is there.
Absolutely. We've applied for a number of different grants from the federal government to assist us in bringing qualified attorneys as well as support staff. Our VOCAL grant, which is a federal grant, helps us employ young people who are interested in that field, specializing in that field. And they come in our office and they concentrate in that direction. That's their main concern. So they're not doing a lot of other different things. So the county council has been very great with saying whatever we need to do to help you get this funding, we will do. At the same time, when we organize the special victim unit, we're specializing in certain types of crimes. So I don't have a deputy who's doing white-collar crime and doing robberies and things of that nature dealing with young children who've been molested or a young lady who has been molested or a young man who has been molested, yet they're talking to an attorney that don't specialize in that, don't have the sensitivity, and don't have the tools necessary to make that person feel comfortable, as well as presenting that case in front of a jury. Now we have four attorneys that we have in our office that do nothing but sex crimes, and they're excellent, and they really present themselves well in front of a jury. They present themselves well in front of a victim who they're talking to and how to handle that victim, how to handle that victim's family, and how to get people motivated to want to prosecute these cases. Because many times cases are dismissed because lack of cooperation.
We only have about a minute left here. Mm-hmm. Prosecutor Carter, what are you looking ahead in the next year, probably before the official campaign gets underway, that you would like to get done?
Yeah, you know, one of the things I'm working with this organization, Indiana Parenting Institute. You can go up online and look at them. They're an excellent organization, and what they're doing is the key to, I think, resolving crime. And I mentioned about law enforcement, not to answer necessarily. The Indiana Parenting Institute, their whole method is to work with parents, to get parents to be better parents, to get parents to understand that they are a key ingredient. They're the first law enforcement of that child's life, and they can keep that child out of trouble. They can help that child have the tools necessary to avoid certain things, that pitfalls that other children can't. And another thing I'm real strong on is children having children. We can't have that. That's a recipe to disaster. I'm real strong, and I'm not coming from a religious standpoint, but I'm real strong on if you want a child, get married. If you have a child, if almost, you know, if possible, get married to that woman, get married to that man. Make that family unit so you be there in that child's life. So when you wake up in the morning, you're talking to that child, you're seeing that child, you're seeing that child go off to school, not a weekend father or not a every 6 months you're there in that child or you're sending a check in. So I'm real strong, and I kind of promote that as much as I possibly can. And I know it's not realistic to the extent that it's going to happen to everyone, but it does resonate. And there are people who say, you know, I'm going to do it the right way. I'm going to wait till I get my education, wait till I have some money in the bank. bank and wait till I find the right person, and that's when I'm going to make that serious step.
Well, it sounds like it's an ambitious campaign to be sure, but it's one that at least you can certainly work toward, and maybe someday you can resolve to be sure.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you for spending time to talk with us about this, and we hope to have a chance. I know that you're a very, very busy person at the County
Government
Center. I
will make time any day.
But I'm glad that you spent some time with us today, and we hope to have a chance to talk again here. Maybe we'll talk a little closer to when the official campaign gets underway, but it's certainly nice to have a chance to chat with you today about the issues that are important here in Lake County, dealing with crime and helping law enforcement. All around. Thank you for being with us. Lake County Prosecutor Bernard Carter. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today and this week. Thanks to Carol Carlson and Hannah Reed with the Post Tribune, Giles Bruce of the Times, Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson, and to Lake County Prosecutor Bernard Carter for the in-studio conversation. And I'm Chris Nolte, and we'll be back with you on Monday at 11 a.m.